Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our regular Monday stream.
Good evening.
We're back.
We're back.
Yes. Part of our long-standing D series, it seems.
This is following on from the many infinites.
Yeah, this
We'll
is.
need to find one that's like an infinite D something.
We'll have to do like infinite D.
Infinite
No, we'll have
defenestration.
D on with the infinite D.
Ah, woo.
We can't do a whole stream about throwing people out of windows. But yes,
We could try though.
hello folks. I see a couple of our members in chat already. Hello to John Morton. Hello to Krillon. Good day, as you say. Where I don't know. Somebody said there's a bit of sunshine today. It's not been too bad. Spring is definitely in the air here in Britain.
Not quite here today, I don't think.
It was okay earlier. You just went up earlier, is what it was.
No.
Ooh.
It was nice yesterday, though.
Yes, but it's getting over the winter blues, but it's not quite there yet. I agree. But yes, we're here talking about another D series, deglobalization. Although we won't jump right into it as people filter in. It's one of our overarching themes, really, that a lot of the stuff about essentially, oh well, we need to live a bit simpler is all. Effectively cope. I guess we can call this the climate cope series,
I mean,
maybe.
partially, but there is also some interesting kind of geopolitical inferences we can take from the way globalization and consequently deglobalization is both framed and presented to us.
Yes.
But we will shall also, in the midst of starting it, whilst people filter in, do a little bit of shilling. We do the little bit of shilling, I
It's
believe.
called We Do a Little Bit of Shilling,
That's the one.
yes. The first piece of shilling we have, as I keep trying to tell people, is if you are UK based, we have our live event, our fourth live event, in 2 years in Nomos, Manchester.
Nomos ex Mises.
Yes, Nomos ex Mises. For those who keep asking me, the nearest train station will be Manchester Oxford Road. I've had a few people ask about that for accommodation purposes. Tickets are £30. Well, I think they're 35. I've forgotten how much our tickets are. They're 35 plus a £3.62 Eventbrite fee. But that does include a nice buffet and canapés and dessert canapés. So you will
It
be
does
rather well
indeed.
fed.
A private venue and a bar until about 2 in the morning, I believe, nearly.
Yep.
We have already announced one, Mr. Christopher Hansen, that will be speaking there, who is a Mises scholar. And we will have another, shall we say, somewhat Mises-associated scholar interviewed, hopefully by the end of this week.
We will do, yes.
But
Slight
we'll also
hint.
say thank you to the people who are members of the channel, those who turn up for the streams and share stuff around. Do the algorithm dances in the comments and
Oops.
whatnot. It's good of you that you do that because it helps show that people are seeing this and that they are willing to show it to other people and that YouTube sees that you want to show this to other people, which is just the way it goes, we're afraid.
We do still have the anti-politics Substack, and there will be more going up there. We've just been rather busy with organizing the Nomos stuff and a few other things, but we've had a couple of weeks off, but there will be more content before the end of the month on anti-politics. I have seen a lot of people filtering through and reading some of our backlog. I have been shilling that, so it's yes, it's something that we do still do. I had a couple of people ask about it, but.
You can also support us via the super stickers and the super chats and a direct link on PayPal, which I believe you have one to read out from last week if you've got it there, or do you want to do that towards the end?
I'll do it towards the end, but I just wanted to say I gave a quick acknowledgement to that person on social media. But thank you for the £10, Kate S. I don't want to completely dox who you are, and I wasn't quite sure if some of the message I would read out or not. But I just want to say thank you to Kate S for your donation,
Appreciate it.
and I'll have a quick look at that again, and I may read it out later on. But yes, I have been keeping an eye on that. Sometimes they are a bit delayed, but we do the best way still to give us. You basically YouTube tax-free income is the PayPal link.
Give us the bennies.
But yeah, we are still fully monetized. So if you wanna, super chat or become a member or whatever, that is still good.
But yeah, so for the stuff this evening, there is a point I kind of want to start on, which will be a good jumping off point for anyone that's familiar of anything, the stuff we've covered from Alul or the little bit of Ted Kay, and especially a little bit of Schmidt, that technology and technique are, in the long run, the suspension of history. A sort of finality, as it were.
Mm.
Each new technical process adds to the last in an effort, in theory, to deal with any possible contingency that could ever happen. But this doesn't work. So instead, such dependency upon technology and technique brews much larger systemic faults and crises which require overarching solutions and provide ever-growing opportunities for arbitration and management. You know, problem, reaction, solution.
Yes.
The sovereign is he who decides on the exception, even more so when he has manufactured said exception.
Very much so. There's a lot of stuff in this stream as well that will be interlinking with one of our previous streams.
Yes.
I know a lot of people did watch this because it's one of our most watched streams. It's the one we did with the Radical Liberation called Non-Day Call It Collapse, where we talk about a lot of the supply chains, the change in the way things are delivered, the change in the way things are traded due to the emerging quote-unquote multipolar world. We will not be talking at length about the supply chains and the globalization kind of logistics issues in this one. These are taken as a given, both within the framework we'll be using and the framework that essentially the globalists use.
Yes.
The idea that there is a lot of trouble delivering things globally is very much taken as read in all this, which means that we'll have basically for the entire episode like a background collapse watch going on.
Just a light sort of horn in the background.
Yeah, it's just constant. We're basically on constant collapse watch because, as you've noticed, some of the stuff we've telegraphed maybe a year ago is super in the news now. They're kind of doing some of our work for us. And as the stream goes on as well, you'll notice there's a lot of bad line, good line stuff in this.
Yes.
In which they're having to redefine what is the bad line and the good line basically on the fly.
It's like the Chad memories at the desk. He's like, have you considered these graphs? West, fallen, we're back, you know, lowering. Anyway. I think one of the first things you've got here in the notes is a quick little bit from like the Scottish government, I believe it is.
Well, I just wanted to have a bit of background, really, that the deglobalization stuff is very much like the degrowth and the demobilization stuff, in that it has a supposed ideological start point, but really it's to do with pragmatism. The pragmatic point here is that the benefits of quote-unquote global governance we were supposed to get, we're not getting any more.
Yeah.
And just like with the reduction in cars on the road, basically what the whole strategy here boils down to is that, you know, the carrot will not be enough. We are bringing out
the stick.
The stick.
Full stick spectrum dominance.
Full stick dominance, yes. I'll have to get like a little stick PNG at some point. Like a magic stick. A beaten stick.
Yeah.
There was
one line I found quite interesting in this. I think it's in one of the later paragraphs. Just
there's a terrible but like bunch of very patronizing.
I think it's
in the
middle two paragraphs under these that two. Image there. Keep going up. Yes, there we go. Research commissioned by the Transport Scotland and undertaken by Element Energy looked at options available to meet Scotland's statutory climate targets. The report concludes that technology alone will be insufficient to meet out net zero targets by 2045. Now, this is something
meet out?
Yeah.
I guess that's technically correct, but it's probably supposed to be meet hour.
Yes.
I would say that. It makes more sense.
Quite possibly. But this is something that, again, we kind of take for a given now, that the ecological arguments are so in the sort of common psyche and come from such a neutral position that it's now the framework they can use almost very easily to say, well, oh, the natural growth of technology within the free market, quote unquote, isn't actually going to solve this problem. So we're going to have to go out and both implicitly and explicitly manipulate human behavior to reach the policy goals we're after.
Well, it's just not that. It's just like, look, whether you want to or not, you're not going to be allowed to use your car. Reduce the use of private vehicles.
But it's the couching in a sort of therapeutic language as well, that they have to do it with such science behind it to break out of the liberal
framework.
Well,
it's just that the little paragraph here is this is basically demobilization stuff. But
yes.
Our national commitment to reduce car use deliberately includes all types of car, including electric vehicles, in recognition of the wider benefits of society less dominated by the movement and storage of private vehicles. So it's basically just saying, you're not going to be able to afford a car. And here's why that's a good thing.
Yes.
A lot of this is the global supply chain is broken down. The global supply chain is on its arse. We've completely failed with just-in-time initiatives. And basically the entire way we do business in terms of globalization has failed. But here's why that's a good thing.
Well, look at one here as well. This would be one for folk who remember us going over the New Britain framework stuff. Which, of course, anyone with a keen eye would have recognised today, the Scottish Daily Express article going around discussing a minimum income guarantee,
yes.
UBI, basically. They're talking here about reducing overall car use is particularly important in light of our commitment to a just transition to net zero emissions. Recognising that the negative impacts of car use fall disproportionately in some of the most vulnerable and disadvantaged groups in society.
Basically, they're saying that poor people don't drive, therefore we're all going to be made to live like poor people.
It's the other way round, actually. What they're saying is that poor brown people drive a lot, so we'll have to subsidize their
travel. No, they don't.
They're,
if you read some other reports, they're saying black people don't drive, therefore no one should drive. That's quite literally in some of the reports.
Fair enough, but the notion here is not so much which direction it's happening. And
yeah, despite the fact that these groups are less likely to have access to private vehicles. There it is.
Oh, fair enough. But there is an excuse here for arbitration, which seems to be your favourite word of the last few weeks. That not only is it, oh, well, we must have a transition to net zero travel, but it must be a just one.
Yes.
Every element of the transition must be managed with an infinitesimal detail to make sure that the transition to net zero is equitable.
Well, it's the whole thing about if you need it. There'll be a lot in here about, you know, arbitrating what people do and don't need in terms of the global economy.
Mm.
We are, however, committed to maintain access by car for those who need it, such as those who use cars as a mobility aid, such as though. God, this is full of typos.
Mm-hmm.
This is terrible. I just thought I was being dyslexic there, but that's awful. Yeah, nothing like artificial scares to step on the throats of the plebs.
Let them drive EVs.
Yes, let them drive.
But as you sort of said at the start here, there is a sort of false dichotomy that comes out of this that is similar as the degrowth sort of framework. There is the sort of bad isolationism of the past.
Yes.
And there is the unlimited consumption of the present in the free market. And that we are only going to get the quote-unquote good parts of these, which means getting neither of the good parts of both of those.
No.
As far as we would recognise it. So what you're going to get is expensive goods and porous borders.
Well, as we found with all of these, as you put in the notes, government report finds that more government action is required to reach societal government-set goals. Once again, through a therapeutic lens, states are stepping out of the liberal framework and directly justifying both explicit and implicit manipulation of human behaviour, and also just the explicit and implicit idea that you will subsist,
yep.
And your life will be materially worse for what are very nebulous higher goals.
Yeah. Globalism always had an unsustainable carrot of cheap goods and unlimited cheap travel for the Western populace, but now it is all stick.
Maybe we could just bring out, like, the infinite stick.
Yeah.
Yeah. the plank-scale carrot and the infinite stick for the physics nerds out there. The first place I think both of us sat up and noticed the term deglobalization as, like, a globalist watchword, which seems like an oxymoron.
It's a FT article from 2021 or 2022. I'm trying to remember now.
It's from the snapshot is from 2022, but I'm not actually.
I think the original itself might be from 2021.
No, it's from 2022. Is it? I believe. Yes, because it said it was published 16 minutes ago as of the snapshot.
But this is Larry Fink talking about how the war in Ukraine marks the end of globalization. It's like, wow, that's some pretty big talk.
Well, it's. As we'll find, it's the inner and outer party. It's the end of globalization for the outer party. It's the end of the globalization kind of party for me and you. Really, the lockdowns were.
Mm-hmm.
The deliberate manipulation of all of that to create a situation in which there was effectively a lockdown of all Western nations simultaneously was the death knell of globalization, or at least in the we are citizens of the world, we can buy anything from anywhere sense.
The illusion of the not necessarily no borders, because obviously it very much continues, but the illusion that globalism was pluralistic,
yes,
in some sort of sense, has faltered somewhat. And this is something we've talked about and we'll probably bring up a number of times across the stream, just as one sort of example. But when you have, you know, this sort of stuff with anti-colonialism sprinkled over the top of it, what you have is globalization for brown people who are recolonizing the colonizers.
Yes.
And you have demobilization for the imperialist colonizers who are now being colonized themselves.
Well, it does mention COVID here as well. It says, I'll try and find the line there. It's not actually in this one. Where did he pull that line from?
That's not mine, that's yours.
That might be something I'm reading wrong then. Oh no, it's in the little bit. Anyway, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has put an end to the globalization we've experienced over the past three decades, Fink wrote in his annual chairman letter to shareholders of BlackRock. Yeah, that's I believe we've read some of his annual letters before. They're quite telling.
Yes.
Part of the article goes on to say, no, this is stuff you added.
In
response to COVID-19, Russia's war with Ukraine and climate change, governments and global companies are seeking security and resilience over the benefits of the global value chains.
I think that may be from, I think you may have got that from the letter itself.
Yes, possibly. I think that is in the letter itself. I just wanted to pull that out.
The other line I've put in there I just thought was kind of funny because of the way he says it.
Yeah. There it is.
Longer term, I believe that recent events will actually accelerate the shift towards greener sources of energy. You don't say. Because higher prices for fossil fuels will make a broader range of renewables financially competitive. Oh, if we make gas and petrol that people have been used to using for decades really expensive, they'll have to use alternatives. Whoa, the market. Isn't it beautiful?
Well, the last two paragraphs you talk about as well is that looking ahead, Fink made clear that BlackRock wants employees back at the office, but will not be among those employees who insist on the complete return to pre-pandemic norms. The last two paragraphs are again an admittance that the good aspects of globalism in regards to capital elites will remain the same. Those stuck within the machine will be subject to greater manipulation. We begin to get an inkling as to what globalization truly means. Your nation isn't free and democratic until its economy is fully opened up to global American empire interests, or democratic until its bourgeois culture is supplanted with global homo values.
I mean, this is again, these are some givens, but what we're trying to do is work these into what our understanding of globalization within the context before us actually is. And you can get little hints of that through the Larry Fink article you've got here. Some of the other ones are going to come up in the future. So just keep these sort of points in mind.
There's a slightly, not deeper dive, but it's interesting because there's so many different opinions on deglobalization of what it actually is.
Yes.
There's the deglobalization that's been a result of the Ukraine war, in quotes. There's the deglobalization that is actually a good thing that is fighting climate change. There's the deglobalization that's due to the long-term effects of the lockdowns. A lot of it is recognition of reality and a veneer over it, which is a theme that we see a lot in all of this when we talk about, you know, the climate subsistence narrative. There's a lot of this is happening, but we made it happen, but we didn't make it happen, but it's a good thing, but it's a bad thing. There's a lot of just running around sort of trying to cover a bunch of cracks.
Well, it goes to show as well how, in a certain sense, we could say that nationalization, in a certain sense, is opposed to globalization.
Yes.
Or is maybe, in a certain other view, a stepping stone from one to the other. But it's not like they're saying here that globalization is taking a hit in the face of nationalism.
No.
Maybe unless in some really like specific neocon corners where they would be talking about how Russia's becoming a big scary nationalist force or something like that.
There's bits and pieces of it sprinkled in as... one of the things we'll read to kind of finish the stream does mention it, but it mentions it in a really weird way.
Well, this is part of the thing I was going to get to, though, is that what they mean is globalization in the face of other imperial forces, like China,
yes,
Russia, Brazil, sort of pigs countries. The what they're really talking about is supremacy over these forces.
Yes.
And there has been enough, at least... enough nose-cutting to spite one's face carried out by the Western regimes and putting COVID forward, that they have actually maybe put themselves on a back foot in that front.
Well, there's another article here from the Financial Times that was just amusing to me because of how confused it is. This is somebody called Adam Tooze, who is trying to filter the world essentially through 1990s eyes. This is really somebody who must have at some point have bought into Fukushima's The End of History.
Yes, and that's why I mentioned it at the start.
Fukushima, that's the nuclear plant.
Francis Fukuyama.
Fukuyama, yeah. Might as well be Fukushima for all the good he did. but it's the whole thing about the new Cold War and hegemony. Basically, what it's saying in a roundabout way is that the global community, in quotes, has been redefined to merely include all of the countries closest to American hegemony. And those who are not even really bucking it fully, but subscribe to the previous version of it, like China, since China has spent so long really in America's pocket, despite many, many of the geopolitical pretensions of China as an existential enemy. They still share such a huge manufacturing base with America, it's almost ridiculous that they could come to actual blows. But
well, especially as well when you begin to pick apart the IOU debt swap deals that exist that sort of in one phase and in the other keep both the yuan and the dollar afloat at heads, at loggerheads between one another. It's all a very intricate mishmash of stuff going on.
Well, basically he talks about the determinism of some of the old 90s economics.
Hmm.
Talks about, you know, you dismiss talk of globalization as option one. This debunking posture has an air of empiricism and common sense about it. It's almost like a neocon Randian stance.
Yeah, it's like the IEA stance of, well, despite the fact that history has reared its head, given things enough time, the market will continue to globalize the world anyway. And yeah. It's kind of interesting to see that commentators for the Financial Times are having to kind of sidestep around this.
Yeah.
Either one, to not seem like a total kind of Adam Smith, Ricardian, determinist in sort of economic terms, but also in the same way, not just out and out being like, well, no, we have to globalize the market economy through the arms of the state, and sort of showing their hand that this was always, you know, like a welfare state project to have such globally reaching trade.
Well, through his framing, he's like, is this just a short-term tiff? Is this just a kind of a new Cold War dynamic in which people understand things in pre-1991 terms? But kind of at the end here, there's a whole thing about the third position, which I don't think he thought that out particularly well. but yeah. You might shrug and ask whether the melange of geopolitics, economic nationalism, and the occasional pandemic is really new. Is this not just history, as we have always known it, unpredictable and red in tooth and claw? But in saying that, you have to give the game away. The promise of globalization, as it was understood from the 1990s onwards, was precisely that it would usher in a new era. He's talking about the end of history. So to admit that not only that a slew of unexpected and diverse shocks is disrupting the world economy, but they are multiplying and becoming more intense, is in fact to admit a fundamental disappointment of expectations. This really is where even slightly buying into the Fukuyama end of history stuff comes to bite you in the arse. Because yes. You become completely incapable of filtering reality. whereas the advocates of business as usual declare that it is still the economy, stupid. And the new Cold Warriors rally around the banner of democracy versus autocracy. The third position faces the reality of confusion, the kind of confusion registered by a term like polycrisis. It's something that we saw, as he talks about, during Davos in 2023, and it risks becoming a cliche. But as a catchword, it serves three purposes. It registers the unfamiliar diversity of the shocks we are that are assailing what would previously seem the settled trajectory of global development. It insists that the coincidence of shocks is not accidental but cumulative and endogenous, there we go. And by its currency, it marks the moment at which bullish self-confidence about our ability to decipher either the future or recent history has begun to seem at the same time facile and passe. What a word salad in many cases. But what he's basically saying is, if you don't see things through the lens of the elite are in charge and deliberately collapsing things to kick the plebs in the teeth, you actually don't have a way forward of looking at this.
No.
All three of those options don't work. It isn't the Cold War, it's not business as usual, and it isn't just the global elites being taken
to
surprise.
This is almost like a weird like mold bug article.
Yeah.
I could have imagined sort of him writing this recently, really.
I guess this would make us fourth positionists.
Yes.
In that we are the ones who subscribe to the controlled demolition theory. So what we are seeing is the deliberate reduction of living standards before they organically crumble back down because of the kind of enforced Malthusian disaster that is managerialism.
And with such a fitting statement on that, what better time to go to our friends at the World Economic Forum?
Well,
to have their little input on this. The 17th of January 2023, what are the odds?
Well, it's the whole point that this really, this is a World Economic Forum article, but it is mostly ripped.
They wrote it for my birthday, I'll have you know.
It is mostly ripped from a September article by Barclays Investment Bank, of all people.
Well, that innocent and minor institution that is neutral and non-political.
Yeah, but Barclays.
There's those global value chains that... Is this where you'd maybe got that phrase from? Because it says it right there.
Oh, yes, I believe so. But I must have misplaced that quote. I also believe that the global value chain quote was partially... It may have been quoted by Fink.
Mm.
In his... I'm pretty sure it was, actually. I'm pretty sure these are all referential to each other, which is why I put it there.
That would make a lot of sense.
Because this article, or this little piece, is entitled Homecoming, The Acceleration of Deglobalization. And this is being written essentially by one of the world's largest merchant banks. So when they say something, unless it is complete, like, virtue signal garbage, you should probably at least pay some attention.
Yeah, if anyone for one reason or another happens to have what they refer to as a client login to get the full report for that there, I would quite appreciate a look at that.
I found the full report elsewhere. It's kind of trite.
Gosh, yes.
It's full of investor speak as well.
No!
So it's not very nice. But the little paragraph here goes, in response to COVID-19, Russia's war on Ukraine and climate change, governments and global companies are seeking security and resilience over the benefits of global value chains. There are strong signals that the era of globalization is coming to an end. Note the triple rationale there. COVID-19, we couldn't have seen it coming. Russia's war, we are sacrificing for a reason, and climate change, we're doing it deliberately because it's the right thing to do. There are actually three competing and, in many ways, mutually exclusive rationales contained in the single sentence there. Just sitting out there like a trio of turds on the pavement. it's just amazing how we're supposed to accept all of this, because I guess it's just so drummed into people as the narrative.
Well, it goes to show how fast things are moving now. Like,
yeah,
it felt as if the Middle East paradigm that lasted for decades, and they were still talking about it in like 2016, 2017, trying to kick the dead horse of Syria.
Yes,
and it's just like all of a sudden that's all gone now. It's all Ukraine. We were always at war with Eurasia. You know, because not to rehash all the 1984 stereotypes.
Yes,
but
it is a weasel word as well. I saw people say in that saying the settled. It's very settled science. There's a settled trajectory of history. I hate the Whig view of history. I hate the Whig view of history. It's also the Marxist view of history. I hate the Whig view of history. Watch Democratization.
Yes, pretty much.
But there's a few more things in here. It talks about globalization through recent history. These are a bit facile. Sentiment is turning towards deglobalization. Deglobalization isn't completely global. There is a talk about the European Commission and some of the isolation of China and some of the isolation of Russia as well. Higher chance of cross-border deals competing completely within Europe and North America. So basically what they're saying is that Europe, as we've all talked about, is the real target of the war in Ukraine.
Of course.
Semyon Gog talks about this at length, and it's a very salient point that one of the major goals of the Ukraine conflict was to kick the shit out of the EU as a possible rival castle to America, yep, which it has done successfully. And a lot of the lower chance of cross-regional deals completing when the target firm is in Europe or North America. It's, like I said, it's a broadening of the alliance between the EU and the US in terms of its benefit to the US. And it's a semi-exclusion of, quote-unquote, the rest of the world, as they are not as engaged in American hegemony, as they try and essentially turn them fully into vassal states.
What do you mean? You mean the US is using its satellite states to attack Europe once again?
Well, it talks about the green transitions will create new winners and losers. Energy is a key sector to watch in terms of both globalization and deglobalization. The common incentive for nations to address climate change has been a major source of globalized cooperation in years. Yet the mechanics of the green transition itself also necessitate a more local focus. This is the local tyranny we spoke about. You will be getting essentially global power, but it will seem to be being operated by your local council, your local police force, and your local community.
Yeah, it's the 15-minute city,
yes,
managed by the global framework. So the policing, the resources, the economy you deal with will seem as if it's all on your doorstep, when really that sort of localism is actually pinging upon global systems of trade and finance and information management. The only reason you could ever have a work from home job that allows you to live the 15-minute city is because you're engaging in labour that's happening somewhere else across the world.
This is a badly formatted website. Look what happens when I zoom in too far. It all goes, all over itself. Web design's terrible. I could do a better job than this. The reduction of carbon-intensive transportation infrastructure and carbon pricing mechanisms acting as de facto tariffs. What an admission.
Yep.
It's a huge tariff from the West to the rest in terms of competing with them. That's really what it is. A lot of the deglobalization stuff in terms of it's good because of climate is really just the rationalization of the big no-no that is protectionism. But it is really global, you know, the global American empire putting protectionism within its own borders, which means the UK, Europe, the US, some parts of Africa, some parts of Asia, Australia and New Zealand.
See, I'm on a completely different subject here, but also on the same subject, I'm currently reading a Cato piece from 2019 that says, what was that again? Tony Blair is right. Globalization is a fact, not a choice. From the Cato Institute, that libertarian institute, I believe so.
Yes.
They've got a little bit quoting from Mark Carney here, though, where he's talking about populist forces pushing back against globalization and might now be set for a period of deglobalization on trade, given the possibility of a no-deal Brexit and the ongoing US-China trade war. But any government would find it extraordinarily difficult to take away the ability to travel, study, interact, and freely exchange information from those who have already tasted that freedom. That was in March 2019. And then by March 2020, we had lockdown. Oh, no one could have seen this coming, except from when it did.
Well, I don't want to read the whole thing. There's a little bit of mentioning in kind of Barclay's own little verticals of this. There was another page, but the images were really low res and really not worth viewing. I was kind of appalled by some of the quality of it. But they mentioned in that the fact that a lot of the net zero and some of the deglobalization stuff is actually being led by the courts.
Yes.
That there's going to be an emergence of court cases, both in terms of ESG and in terms of net zero. That means that governments who are facing up to the realities of lower living standards for their populations will be able to point at the courts and say, it's their fault. Courts did it.
Well, yeah, no,
the judges made us do it.
It's one of those perfect bits that works again from Gottfried's framework in the therapeutic state, that the government agrees to a subset of compliance rules that it knows it can't ever really meet, and then allows the courts to hold it to standard about how well how are you actually going to meet net zero? There needs to be more transparency. So now there's an excuse to start a whole new bureau that's going to deal with a transparency report about net zero. And at the same time, everyone can put their hands up and go, well, we're powerless.
Yes.
Exactly as you were saying there.
It's very much kind of a shell game. It's the shell game we talked about with the demobilization stuff, and it's a shell game when it comes to the benefits of globalization no longer applying to populations. You've noticed a lot of this is talk about supply chains and delivery, but there's nothing that talks about really the rollback of quote-unquote global governance. Deglobalization is happening in practical terms. It's happening for private industry, but it's not happening for the supranational elite. There is no talk of decoupling politics in terms of international relations. There's no talk of actual nationalism, apart from as a dirty word. The deglobalization in terms of climate is a deglobalization for you, not for them. And that is one of the biggest things that you can take away from all of the climate stuff, is what we always talk about, inner party, outer party.
Mm.
You are not one of the elite, and you will not reap a lot of these benefits, in quotes, they're talking about. Some of this, especially the stuff we saw from Barclays there, was a bit in-group preference kind of focused.
Sorry, I hate to interrupt, but somebody's just blew up one of those bags of like powder and paint on the table in the middle of the bloody Joe Perry-Robert Milkins match.
Oh, no.
Bastards.
Absolute bastards. There's something here that I found. It's quite a good resource, actually.
Here we go to the... Is this the accidental rabbit hole you went on the other day?
It is, yes. Before that, though, I realised that this isn't in here for some reason. It mustn't have opened when I clicked it. But this is a quick illustration of the deglobalization doesn't mean deglobalization thing.
Mm.
There's one here from Project Syndicate. I believe this is where it's from originally, from Rajagram R. Grajan, who probably is going to be a Tory minister by the end of the week. but he talks about deglobalization in terms of policy and an international cooperation is a climate threat. So he's talking about the globalism that we would recognize.
Mm.
Not the weird supply chains, I can order ramen from China in half a day globalism that we've, you know, not the AliExpress globalism that we are sold as the picturesque.
Well, this is almost like him. He must have like saw our green imperialism stream.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh no, shit. We're not going to be able to buy like LPG gas anymore because the EU is going to put some sort of tariff on our corn bloody imports do that and starve us.
Globalization may have fallen out of favor in recent years, but preserving it is an environmental imperative. Effective coordinate response to climate change are being set back by the shrinking of cross-border trade and investment flows, and by the accompanying rise of isolated regional trading blocks.
Only in the immense confusion that is modernity could a man put his hand up and say, actually, shipping things around the world in several, like, you know, 100,000-ton ships that burn this much oil and planes and trains and this, that, and the next thing, it's good for us. I just there's something just so brazen about that.
It's funny, he talks about the three challenges of climate action, mitigation, adaptation, and migration. Ooh. Thank you, Mr. Indian Man.
No, this is, he's not understood the colonialist aspect to this framework, has he?
No, he's not.
Don't worry, Mr. Pajit. Globalization still exists for you, my friend, but not for us.
Well, he talks about friends sorting, limiting trade to countries with shared values. A little bit of Turbo America there. This is almost like a third worldist position, where he's talking about the fact that please don't retreat the like global liberal hegemony. We suckle from that teat, and our weird managerial positions in our home countries might be threatened if you start looking a bit more inward to your own problems. Agreements will be easy to reach, blah, blah, blah. Talks about China. This is like the naive version, really.
Yeah. At minimum, the international community should negotiate a Geneva Convention-style pact to create safe spheres of continued global interaction that are protected from sanctions and bans in most circumstances.
So it's basically saying that there should be an exception, but not an exception. He's effectively saying, we want American hegemony, but please, please, please don't let it shit on us. Please. We don't want to be shit on. We're already struggling. He was the former governor of the Reserve Bank of India, which is why this is like a third worldist perspective. But that this really tells you the position, the precarious position of people of India who are stuck between the two worlds. Look,
just to that last phrase there, though. If we cannot currently agree on a global climate action plan, we must still preserve the basis for cooperation. There can be no effective climate change or climate action without continued globalization. Now, of the very small number of people who have read the essay I wrote for Witan last year, this is exactly the things I was talking about, and it's there is a framework that allows you to understand propaganda that really gets you from the basic stuff the Bolsheviks did to here.
Yes.
Because all the framing around climate change for 30 years, 40 years at this point has been that climate change is a global problem that requires global solutions.
Yes.
And that they have been hammering that home for so long now that there are actually people putting their hands up when Western governments do something in the face of globalization and say, but what about all these global problems you were going to solve?
Yeah, it's, again, it's a balancing act for them because they've said, like, so much shit. They've said so much shite about all of these different things. I forgot to say thank you, Evan W. I won't dox you for your donation last week as well. That was very much appreciated. That was the other one that I missed in terms of donations. But yes, there is a weird kind of deglobalization paper that the EU put out, which is basically just a roundup of everything that think tanks are saying. There's quite a lot of stuff here. I won't go through all of it in detail because who is talking about it and what they are talking about broadly is much more interesting, than kind of the direct detail of the subject matter. It's just all of this stuff. We'll go through who some of these people are first, but the first one that caught my eye was from the Council on Foreign Relations.
As you do.
As you do. Those of you who've studied your history will know who the Council on Foreign Relations are.
I think that's actually, like, if you don't know who the Council on Foreign Relations are, leave.
No. do some research in your own time. I would recommend looking up the actions of the Council on Foreign Relations in the interwar period and in terms of how it helped intensify, lengthen, and deepen the Second World War. That's who we're dealing with here. But they talk about the globalization myth. Which, this whole thing is really waffle. It's basically them talking about the fact that America goes round, sets up little imperial production bases, and then quote-unquote regionalizes them into the international trade network. It's basically trying to reframe the fact that American hegemony has always been international trade, and that the expansive commercial ties of Mexico and Canada create a bigger market for US goods. BRICS, not BRICS, what's it called? NAFTA. It's very kind of wannabe Clinton administration stuff, writ large. It's kind of a wish list of America is international trade and international trade is America.
Yes.
Rising tide lifts all boats, but only when led by America. it's extremely boilerplate.
We must make the world safe for freedom, democracy, liberated markets, greater production, more specialization. It's one of the parts that many people who are libertarians are unwilling to admit, is that much of the natural law sort of mindset, even of some of the scholastic folk, were not tied to ardent aspects of the Catholic faith or Protestant faith, leads to this.
It's from a bit, it's from their verse called Renewing America and the Western Hemisphere in the Global World. Again, a lot of the Council on Foreign Relations stuff in terms of globalization is turbo America writ large. It is the idea that America will be the hegemon and everyone will fall closer in line and ever further in line. But it's funny that they've got this globalization myth, essentially, again, trying to cope with the fact that the global supply chain and the globalist system effectively collapsed in about 2019 and they needed lockdowns to cover the whole thing up. But there is also just a huge amount of stuff here from both some people called the Friends of Europe and also Brookings as well. But I'll go through some of the Friends of Europe stuff first.
Who are directly a derivative of the EU Commission, I believe. And also work hand in glove with the Council on Foreign Relations.
They work with the Council on Foreign Relations for Europe, and they are also directly really part of the... here we go. Co-funded by the European Union. Says it there right at the bottom. So this is effectively the European Union's pet think tank. And on the board of trustees, we find a guy called Etienne Davignon, who, if you remember our White March stream, was one of the most prominent people named in the testimony of witnesses who were disallowed during the Dutroux affair. He's the president of the Friends of Europe, and he was the Belgian Minister for State and former European Commission Vice President.
Yeah, you have. I'm not exactly sure where this quote from, I'm sure you'll tell us in a moment. But the testimony of X2 implicated that Etienne Davignon, Maurice Lippens, Paul van den Bonjans, Benoit de Bonfaison, and Prince Alexandre of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha were named as having been present at orgies including underage persons. Sorry, I thought that was undergrads at first. No. Then it got a lot worse.
It did do. So basically, Etienne Davignon, who's president of the Friends of Europe,
is actually a blood-sucking paedophile.
Yeah, he was named by multiple witnesses in the Dutroux affair and helped cover up like the institutional rape and murder of children in Belgium.
Yeah. Also, if you've not seen our White March stream, go and watch you that as well.
I'd recommend caution if you have children. not just playing it around them, but also the fact that it is not a pleasant sit. It's one of our more difficult streams to watch, but it is definitely worth it. I just went into people that have an idea of who they're dealing with.
Is that some black baroness further down there?
I believe it is, yes.
Baroness Valeria Amos.
Master of University College, Oxford, and trustee of the Friends of Europe.
1997. Don't tell me she's from like a fucking Blair thing.
Yeah, she is. She was appointed a Labour life peer. She's a Labour...
First black woman to serve in the British cabinet as Secretary of State for International Development.
And now she's on
become the leader of the House of Lords.
Yep.
In addition to her career at local and national level in the UK, she serves as Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs at the UN.
Well, the Council on Foreign Relations is definitely part of the American government. Everybody knows that. Mm. Everybody who studied it knows that. But the Friends of Europe is part of the EU, does partner with the European Council on Foreign Relations, is just an extension of the globalist machine.
Yes.
It's what we keep talking about, in that it doesn't actually matter who all these large NGOs are, because they are just an extension of elite power. They are all part of the same monolith. It is all the same superstructure who is saying all of this. That's why they're all saying the same things. That's why there's such unity. And that's why they're... Really, we should take notice of them. These aren't just charities and think tanks. These are the movers and shakers. These are barons, these are ministers, these are vice presidents of the EU.
When you try and explain like the framework of Burnham and managerialism to people, I think there is a tendency for them to think only of like someone who's like a regional manager of a certain business, or someone that's maybe some kind of semi high-flying bureaucrat. But there is like an entire strata of people that goes from those who do small amounts of like behavioral manipulation as a manager on a small work site, right up to like propagandists, you know, political elites operating at this kind of level. These are all from the same managerial cloth, as it were. They just
Yes.
operate at different levels.
They all move with complete fluidity between supposedly politically neutral NGOs,
To business
think tanks,
roles, to
business roles,
charities,
charities, ministers in Europe, ministers in countries,
consultant
consultants,
role.
heads of departments. They're all able to do almost any job at any time within a managerial structure. That is how, like, we've talked about it before, the fake cycling of elites works. These people never go away. They just get cycled into a different role. They are a permanent class of people. And all of this is a great demonstration of it. In fact, stuff later on will be an even better demonstration of
Yeah,
it.
I'm just I've noticed
Well,
where
our
we're
old
going
friend,
with this one here.
the Great Reset, towards an existential geopolitical order, question mark.
The world has entered a phase of deep and accelerated transformation, affecting all aspects of the post-World War II Western model for political convergence.
That's almost something we talk about.
Yeah.
Christ.
Francis Fukuyama, the American political scientist, could
It's
have not
back.
been less visionary when some 30 years ago he predicted the worldwide spread of liberal democracies and free market capitalism of the West and its lifestyle might signal the end point of humanity's social cultural evolution. No. Because as we have learned over the last 30, 40 years, brown people cannot be adopted to those systems.
Civilization
Is
is
incommunicable.
incommunicable.
That's the one. Incommunicable.
Yes. In fact, the growing US-China rivalry has put an end to the post-Cold War unipolar moment. It is also accompanied by a historic rising of non-alignment throughout the global South. At the same time, the Western socio-economic system is being challenged from within as liberal democracy and free market capitalism are both confronted with their own limits and contradictions. It's just saying what we say from the other direction. They're saying basically that there was this false idea of convergence. There was this time of unsustainable, complete American hegemony in the 1990s. And now what's happened is that the arse has begun to fall out of it.
Yeah, after the early warning of the 2008 financial and economic crisis, the COVID-19 pandemic decisively whistled down, that should really be whittled, or whistled the end of the decades of deepening globalization. A full-scale war is now developing on European soil.
European soil.
Full-scale war.
European soil, eh?
And major energy disruptions are within sight for European economies. Global strategic supply chains are being dismantled. Public debt has exploded, and both inflation and commodity prices have risen to decade highs, triggering a major risk of extended starvation across the world. Not bloody likely. We're no lucky enough.
Yeah. Just a matter of months, the crucible of Western model has been torn into pieces. But talk about the Paris Agreement here, nuclear deterrence, no longer prevails, global conflicts become a real possibility.
What are they concluding to with the
The
bottom of this
last
here?
beacon of hope for renewed multilateral cooperation and international convergence to tackle the
My
global
God,
climate
that's
challenge.
a larger leap than I would even be willing to make, but it is a very interesting one to consider.
Yes.
That the global effort for climate change might be one of the very few things that allows the American unipolar system to control to actually survive.
Well, that's what they're talking about here. They're talking about trying to preserve the unipolar Francis
They
Fukuyama
are
fake end
actually
of
gonna
history. Yeah.
collapse Western Europe,
Yeah.
wholly import the Third World,
Yeah.
leave America as the last castle.
Yes. That is quite literally what they're talking about
But
here.
it's the fact that between this and between some of the other things we have looked at and will continue to look at as we rattle through the last few we've got here, it's just so obvious.
Yeah, they're quite literally talking about a global collapse to benefit like the American Empire. The existential nature of these challenges becomes more evident to the broader public. A window for disruptive societal innovation may open. They're talking there, of course, about the Great Reset.
Order from chaos.
On top of this, political turmoil and acceleration of compounding and converging man-made challenges leaves little doubt that the boiling the frog metaphor might well prefigure the fate of human society under any kind of continuity scenario. Yeah, they're basically saying that you will not have your survival, you will have your survival taken hostage unless you completely remake your society.
Yes.
That's what that's saying.
As the existential nature of these challenges becomes more evident to the broader public, a window for disruptive societal innovation may open, and Europe has the opportunity to be at the forefront of such a revolution, given the unprecedented scale and speed and nature of the EU response in recent weeks. So that was a Freudian slip there. The opportunity. What if we want to turn it down, though? And then they go on here to talk about EU military doctrine. Jeez, oh.
They talk about, you know, even EU military doctrine is being revised, massive military support. They basically talk about an EU army here.
The sacred saint rule of the free market has been cracked. Fiscal measures and market rules can now be adapted so that stakeholders unduly benefiting from the exceptional market situation might see their windfall profits redirected to finance the exceptional public spending required to maintain social stability and keep the economy afloat.
Actually, just communism. So,
socialize the profits.
Communism.
Or sorry, privatize the profits, socialize the losses, but that's both.
Communism. Just actually communism. It's the whole thing. Can it be society collapsing world? It's just like great reset, globalist chest beating writ large.
But why would some of the world's richest people, you know, talking from behest of the European Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations, support economic collectivism? That seems funny.
Well, they're basically talking about the fact that despite de facto deglobalization, the method of, you know, bringing the pieces of full control together are still in full swing.
Mm.
That you will be reset, or, you know, we will bring war to you. And we will build an EU army, and we will go out there and we will get rid of the climate apostates. Is the some of the subtext of all of this. It's kind of a, I'm surprised this didn't receive more attention. But yeah, this is also from, like we said, a think tank that is run by the EU and headed up by somebody who is incredibly likely to be an elite pedophile who's murdered children. So,
just another Wednesday.
Yeah, there's also, I'm not going to read all these, but there's a lot of kind of inner and outer party rhetoric stuff from the Brookings Institute, which is possibly used to be, I think, the Center for the Study of Government or something in the US.
Oh, yeah, you've got a little bit here. As of 2017, the Brookings Institution had assets of $524 million. Its largest contributors include the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, the Hutchins Family Foundation, J.P. Morgan Chase, the Lego Foundation, David Rubenstein, Chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the State of Qatar.
So right there, you've got like the Chairman of the Council of Foreign Relations, who's David Rubenstein. You've got J.P. Morgan Chase. You've got the Hewlett Foundation. You've got Bill and Melinda Gates. And I also believe that's been updated to also include large contributions from both Walmart and the Waltons.
And probably BlackRock.
There is a huge, I think I've got it here, there's a huge like report which has all of their donors on. I don't know if I actually have it up here at all. I think it was too much. But basically everyone contributes to Brookings. And a lot of people contribute to the...
So that they can go ahead and write pieces like the one you were just clicking on there.
Well, I'm sorry, the window is annoying me. I'm going to have to drag this because their web design is fucking appalling and puts all the headlines completely to the left of the page where you can't really read them very well, and makes the whole page completely imbalanced and fucking stupid. But anyway, that's my gripe with their web design. That should work for now. It's difficult to get the whole thing on screen because we try and have, you know, bits of the page cut off so we're not, like, doxing ourselves and things. Anyway, about 7 years ago, a project for public spaces and Brookings joined forces to pilot the BASS initiative on innovation and placemaking with generous funding from Bob and Ann BASS. I'm not sure who they are. I think probably some just big philanthropists. They're basically talking about the 50-minute city here. They're talking about introducing hyperlocal place governance in a fragmented world. They're talking, in Soviet terms, what would be like workers' bus councils and troikas and things like that. They talk about hyperlocal as like the local Soviet, in which you will discuss like your 15-minute city, your traffic mitigation, your again, LTNs.
Perfectly comes back into the New Britain framework.
Yeah.
It's of course, some of the people who are at the forefront of globalism would be the proprietors of a movement of localism.
Yes.
In the same way that the American government, the institution that is engaging in worldwide imperialism, would frame itself as an institution against imperialism.
Well, this is basically just an advert for the Bass Centre and the Project for Public Spaces. But it is, it's all that, oh, we're going to put a park in your street. You're going to wake up one day and your road's going to be blocked off by an eco-park that's full of fucking junkies. That's what all this talks about. But we also have here, does digitizing government payments increase financial access and usage? They basically talk about the globalization stuff in two angles, saying, well...
I'm really glad I can get the opinions of Vainjanti Dize, Liora Clapper, and Harish Natjaharan.
Thank you, Brookings. Very cool.
World Bank.
It's basically talking about the COVID and lockdowns, making physical globalization harder, so there needs to be digital globalization. And also a giant global digital currency and digitizing government payments. Basically, like global UBI shit is what they're talking about here. But that's another one of globalization physically is failing. We'll have to do it digitally.
I reckon we should keep a hold of that one for when we come back round to something very similar to this subject in a few weeks.
Yes, we will. We will probably be reusing some of these. And I'll have to reconfigure my windows in a little bit because they'll look ridiculously off-center when I go to a website that isn't the way Brookings does that. Oh, I hate these people. The Free World and Its Enemies. I think that's supposed to be a kind of an allusion to the open society and its enemies.
Yes.
What Putin's war and China's global ambitions mean for us. Again, this is from lecture in Germany. Konstantin Schelsenmüller, Gutenberg Center for European Studies. He's basically just a big globalist intellectual.
Yeah, the reflections are Legacies was established with the centre to honour its co-founder Guido Goldman. Goldman was also the founder of the German Marshall Fund of the United States and a principal figure in promoting the study of Germany and transatlantic relations after World War II.
So he's probably been like encountered by the
he's Frankfurt probably at the school. Forefront of the denazification programme.
Well, basically what this article says, there'll be notes in our pinned comment when we're done here, but basically what this says is that China and Russia bad. We are justified in stepping back from our globalism.
I added a little bit to your blurb here, so we'll go for it this way. There is arbitration again going on between good deglobalization and bad deglobalization. The American order has a problem. Market-orientated globalization does not make sense in a world of sanctions and escalation with both China and Russia. Instead of admitting that globalism has failed, there is a two-pronged approach. Convince people that they are suffering for a just reason, as the structures that rely on globalism buckle and break down. No chips, no cars, no meat. Be that as a consequence of carbon mitigation or Ukrainian solidarity against Russian imperialism, and that this is really a return to localism rather than doing without, a la the 15-minute cities.
Yes.
Then they redefine the global community into consisting of countries that explicitly align with American hegemony, and sidestep the idea that attempting to bring China and Russia fully under global rule requires forms of protectionism in the short term, a la Silicon Wars. Very free world. This builds on what the GAE has done since 1918, remaining in the position of global arbiter of freedom and democracy, an empire built on anti-imperialism.
Well, all of these people are desperately trying to explain why globalization has failed. Like I said, they are all funded by Microsoft Corporation is one of the biggest contributors to Brookings now.
Mm.
It is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the government of Qatar. All of these people have aligning interests.
Oh, you try to say these people do not have our best interests in mind.
And all of these people completely control every single one of these top-line NGOs. As we commented to each other off air, it'd be far too obvious if there was just the global Ministry for Information.
I think I actually put that as a note at the bottom here.
Yeah, we'll get into that as a later thing as well. But this is why all these tentacles must exist. A lot of people get very confused by like the NGO mass.
Mm.
But really, it's just a way to pretend 1,000 voices are saying what one is saying. It is a false choir. It is a kind of political chorus effect, if you want to put it that way. That's where all that comes from. Again, have you read this, the last paragraph there?
Yes.
One of the biggest issues we see currently is silicon and kind of chip manufacture. Semiconductors have become, to the modern world, what oil was to kind of the late industrial period. The manufacture of silicon chips and dominance in terms of technology in Taiwan, in terms of the nanometer wars and the effectiveness and TSMC and all of that, they really are ahead. That's not like a fake thing. They really are quite far ahead of a lot of people, because Samsung and Intel kind of shit the bed a little bit. But a lot of the disquiet, let's say, and the neo-protectionism, and the real kind of failure of America to bring a lot of these industries home has been rooted in this anxiety about the fact that globalization doesn't work.
Well, look at this in the face of what the Scottish government were saying, though. They were saying that technology will not be enough. Well, what if the technology fails as well? Then what would be enough?
Yes.
You know, it makes you realize that the culmination of a collapsed global economy on top of degrowth measures, you know, it's just a double whammy. It's complete and utter. I mean, this is the point where you do get to the sort of, well, do we basically call their bluff? Do we think that they are lying about doing these things and that they actually will restart things like chip manufacturing and shipping, and they'll pay lip service to what bits China wants at Taiwan to make sure that we can still buy new cars and new phones? Or are they going to believe their own words, drink their own Kool-Aid, and put us back into the Dark Ages? Which would kind of be based.
I don't think they're going to put us... They're going to pretend to do both, basically.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. It is the tech will not be enough. But this really is what's bubbling under the surface with the globalization is bad, but also good, but also bad. They can't seem to make their minds up anymore because they spent so long building up the idea of a global government, of global governance, of an America-led world that is just and pure and will get rid of all the autocracies. But also, global trade has failed. A ship got stuck in the Suez Canal, and now you can't buy bread.
No.
That was the narrative about a year ago. The
Chinese wet market had some strange bats that gave people a funny cold, so now there's no domestic egg production in the UK.
And the globalization and the outsourcing of large parts of the American economy has been a disaster, and they are now failing to bring those parts home, even though they desperately think that they need to.
Mm.
That is what's going on here.
As an aside here, you've got a couple, just for the sake of, I think, thoroughness, that you've got them there. I think that's something we all know now.
Yeah.
Flying, and I don't mean just privately in terms of jets, but I mean flying as being a personal, private choice that you make.
Yeah.
Is not going to be the case anymore.
No, I just meant to put this
Jet
in here.
Jet zero
is the big thing. Basically, you by 2040, no one in the UK will fly. If you're not part of the elite class, or you have some sort of like a business trip pass.
Or you're not an immigrant.
Yeah, from the government. Or you're not an immigrant being flown in. You will not be allowed to fly. That's what all this is effectively saying. I just wanted to use this as, it's deglobalization, but it's also demobilization. You are being demobilized and deglobalized whilst the governments of the world are becoming closer and the power structures above you are becoming further away.
They're not going to ban flying because, of course, they need to make use of it as a technology, especially in the moments where history might rear its head and flying diplomats from one end of the world to the other helps them. That's what I mean by it will no longer become a personal sort of choice.
Well, it's also the whole, there's like a thing here, a consortium of MPs saying, oh, you can reduce aviation emissions and reach jet zero without forcing people to give up flying. But in discussing forcing people to give up flying, you admit that forcing people to give up flying is part of the dialectic.
Mm.
There is like a compromise point here where there's a lot of Tory MPs saying, oh, well, we might not need to ban people from flying, but it's an admission that they're going to have to ban people from flying. There's a Guardian piece here from a year ago. Scientists pour cold water on UK aviation's net zero ambitions. It's basically just the Guardian to that previous one going, no. Weirdly sober, this one. Country would need to devote half its farmland or more than double its renewable electricity supply, say study. The UK would have to devote half its farmland, its total renewable energy supply, to make enough aviation fuel to meet its ambitious jet zero or net zero flying, scientists said. Turns out kerosene is extremely energy dense. You can't just manufacture it out of thin air or, like, you know, biodiesel. It is a very specific and energy dense fuel because, you know, the thermodynamics of flying means that you need to get greater work out of the fuel. That's why they operate at higher temperatures. So it's a basic part of how energy flow works. A report published on Tuesday by the Royal Society argues there is no single clear sustainable alternative to jet fuel that could support the current level of flying. Basically, you will not be allowed to fly if they go for the targets that are, by the way, legally set upon them. They are not allowed to miss these or else the courts will come after them. Should we give up flying for the sake of the climate? This is from February 2020, just before the lockdowns. It's weird. It's this, all this narrative was supposed to be started by the reduction in flying during the pandemic, but it's been going on since long before then. Basically, the BBC says you should not fly. You're a bad person if you fly. People feel bad for flying. Here's one from LSE. COVID-19 disruption is our chance to reduce flying for good. How? Basically. And they just say, we've made life worse and less mobile for millions of people, and that's a good thing. Most of our suggestions here would target frequent flyers who travel for business, celebratory breaks, or shopping, together with the slow emergence of the pandemic, fears of reinfection, and the ongoing need to quarantine. They might take popping off for a quick weekend break to New York less appealing. So they're really just being like, look, how do we scare people out of flying? Like, how do we do the behavioral manipulation stuff?
Thank you, Maria Shamina.
Yes, they're all weird Brahmin Indian people. And they all want you to live in the pod and eat the bugs and not go anywhere. And they all think that the lockdowns were a fantastic thing and will save the planet. There's one here as well. The Telegraph's live page is awful and is no longer displaying what it was displaying earlier.
It was meant to be net zero and cost of flights.
There we go. No, that's SpaceX. Wow. Yeah, there it is. Net zero will push, will raise cost of flights, airlines warn. Ticket prices for flights will increase in the coming years as the aviation industry adopts expensive technologies aimed at tackling climate change, according to a new report. This is from today. So it's just all saying the same thing.
Oh, yeah, go back to that for a second there.
Sorry,
you just closed it. Are we going to be able to find it?
It's here.
Yeah. Now, Matt Gorman, chairman of Sustainable Aviation and a senior Heathrow executive, said there would be a green premium for those wishing to fly in the future. He added, this is the critical decade where aviation must prove it will decarbonise. Using probably some sort of horrendous fake hydrogen fuel that probably doesn't work and is going to cause several large Airbus planes to fall out the sky or something.
But the point of all this, and the point I'm driving home by demonstrating about seven different ways that you will not be allowed to fly, is that the promise of globalization was that you will become a global citizen.
Mm.
You will become this nomadic entity, and it doesn't matter that you're from nowhere and that you believe in nothing. Because you can go everywhere,
yes.
And you can believe in everything. And that promise is no longer true. Unless you are...
And now it's nowhere.
Yeah, now it's nowhere. You are from nowhere, you believe in nothing, but you are stuck somewhere that you do not belong, you do not recognise.
Before we get to the one last point from the International Affairs article you want to go over, it relates back to what we were saying earlier. About the way that all of these groups and NGOs and this, that and the next thing are all interconnected. We could solve much of the confusion and discord around the subject of deglobalization by having a global bureau for the management of globalization. But this, of course, would be too obvious.
Yes.
However, what we have and what we've looked at is basically what that is.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no other way to look at the Brookings, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Voice of Europe, or whatever it is, all together, all saying the same thing, all in lockstep with one another, is anything else but that. It's just because they've had to disaggregate it to make it less aware, or less obvious on the face of it, I should say.
It is all the Omni-Party. You'll notice all the legislation slots into itself. The UK is still creating legislation that is interoperable with EU legislation, which is a huge hat tip to the fact that there will be a large rejoin movement that takes up the dialectic, probably in around 2028. Maybe by 2030, the UK will be back in the EU. I'm sorry to spoil the ending for you, but it will. It has to be.
I've yet to see about that, as people would have seen from my tweet the other day, though.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, it's it only matters insofar as the fact that we are pushed into a legal no man's land.
Yes.
Where we were told the power of law was going to be put back in our hands, and it turns out it's actually in nobody's. But we shall finish off with the thing you've got here.
Well, there's an article here from International Affairs, which I found a little bit word salad-y, but there's some amazing
want to find them, I will read through the two paragraphs you'll want to go over.
Yes.
Yep, there you go.
Yes.
Democratization is something else that the liberal international order has purported to do, irrespective of where a state is located on the globe. Democracy is expected to produce internal and external restraints on the use and abuse of power, which is held to be critical for the behaviour of democratic states towards fellow democracies.
Yes.
Democracies are very likely, or very unlikely, to fight one another. As the democratic peace hypothesis puts it, the more the liberal international order revolved over time, the more democracy came to surpass other forms of government as the sole legitimate kind of rule. And of course, anyone that reads the Substack will know, if you believe in democracy, I have to get you, or what, introduce you to the ancient democratic institution of gang rape.
Yes.
The 1970 UN Friendly Relations Declaration, for example, stated that every state has an inalienable right to choose its political, economic, social, and cultural systems, at the behest of the American Empire, of course.
Such formulations have become increasingly rare since the 1990s, and not only in documents emanating from the UN. The African Union, for instance, strongly endorsed democratization in its 2007 African Charter on Democracy, Elections, and Government.
I've got a different one here from what's on that.
Oh, no, that's a one lower down. I'm going to read a little bit further here. Finally, the liberal international order postulated more and more global governance in a growing number of issue areas. These range from development to health, from environment to migration, and from science to technology to human rights. The last of these being at the core of the justificatory discourses on the liberal international order, serving as an engine of global governance. By the 1990s, the human rights field had come to exert considerable influence in the international security realm. There's another little bit here. I don't want to bark at you, stupid thing. It's just that they talk about democratization in almost the same terms we would.
There we go. As for democratization, the times when scholars celebrated the latest wave of these processes have, for the first time, being at least passed. There is plenty of democratic recession. Freedom House reports that 2020 was the 15th consecutive year of decline in freedom worldwide. In 2020, democratic recession was particularly pronounced. Nearly 75% of the world's population lived in a country that faced deterioration last year. In sum, democracy's defenders sustained heavy new losses in their struggle against authoritarian foes, shifting the international balance in favour of tyranny. Scholars have shifted their attention to another global trend, labelled democratic backsliding or authoritarianization. Numerous states, including China and Russia, have moved more towards authoritarianism in recent years. It is also important to remember that democracies do not necessarily generate liberal and democratically orientated leaders. That's very interesting that they would state that, isn't it? The unequal distributional effects of economic globalization have played into the hands of populist leaders and states otherwise as different as, say, Brazil, Hungary, and the United States. So even though they've achieved world globalization, that they got so far along with that project that now it actually looks like it's on a quote-unquote backslide, they are now having to justify further global control because globalization itself was not implemented equitably. And we're all the way back to the original point at the start about transition to net zero.
Well, it's just the fact that the first paragraph you read just says that where goes globalization, goes a liberal democratic order, and that democracies don't fight each other because they're part of American hegemony and they are essentially vassal states within an empire.
I think we should leave that where it is.
Yes.
And we will once again thank people for showing up for the stream this evening. We will remind them, whilst there's a large number of them here, that we are doing our next live event on the 26th and the 27th of May this year. I'm afraid the tickets are already sold out for the evening meal on the 26th, but are still available for the 27th. There'll be a full dinner, a private venue for a good 6 to 8 hours at the very least until about 2 in the morning.
Yes.
Two hand-picked speakers. Hand-picked speakers, along with ourselves, in partnership with the Mises Institute, and we hope to see you all there.
Yes, yes we do. For those of you wondering, there will be a stream on Wednesday.
There will indeed.
We will be talking about
the skills collapse.
Yes, which I wrote a Substack about, but there is, I think, some more to say. Thank you to people. Thank you to all of our members who showed up. There's quite a lot of you I saw in the chat there. Thank you to everyone who watches these streams. I hope it's been elucidating in some way.
Again, as always, if you ever see anyone asking questions about these subjects, or you know, you want your semi-normie friends to somewhat understand this stuff, please do send it along to them, because every time people do that, they seem to get a lot better response than I think they were going to realise.
Yes.
I think there's maybe the assumption from some people that everything on the internet is instantly strange, but we seem to be able to be somewhat normal in some capacities, and that this allows us to effectively communicate rather complex and in-depth ideas to people who are not fully au fait with all the online lingo.
I would say so, yes. I don't know, I've been trialing some... I'll do it at some point.
Some sort of fash wave effect.
Yeah, I don't know, we'll call it scrump wave.
Scrump wave.
I was thinking of making as either an outro or something, or maybe just put something on the channel I can have for people that contains a lot of our mantras. But I have been kind of messing around with bits and pieces of that, but we'll see if that materializes in the future. I'm not quite sure if I want to slightly stylize, let's say, some of the stuff that we do here, but I also think I like some people's intros, but I also think in some ways some of them are kind of gay.
Scrump wave, all in caps with spaces.
As always, I'll remind people to interact with these videos, do comment, do drop us a like, and do subscribe. Become a member, support us, it does all help, and it makes sure that we don't get buried completely by the algorithm. We have all the juicy links down below, and if you can come and see us in person, we'd like that, because that is really the only way we're going to organize to kind of the next level. But again, we're getting a bit long in the tooth here, so thank you guys, and good night.
Good night.